So we'll begin with just a few brief words of introduction, as we normally do. And so you have the creational prologue of Genesis. So you have that in Genesis 1, 1 through 2, 3. So the initial introduction, and that tells about the origin of the world. So where created reality came from. And then you have the origins of the nations. So you have five Toledot headings that give the origins of the nations. And then you have the origins of Israel, five Toledot heading about the origins of the chosen people of God. And so those five headings, you have the generations of Terah, and that tells the story of Abraham. And then you have the generations of Ishmael, the generations of Isaac, the generations of Esau, and then the generations of Jacob. The generations of Jacob is the 10th and final section, beginning in 37:2 and extending through the end of the book. And that's the section we're in now, that we are getting very close to the end of. And so the 10th final heading is divided into a few different sections. And so you have chapter 37, you have division in the family, so the brothers are fighting with one another, and Joseph sold into slavery. In chapter 38, you have Judah apart from his brothers. In chapter 39 through 41, you have Joseph apart from his brothers. And really, Judah and Joseph, the two of them, are the two halves of the nation of Israel. So there's 12 tribes, but all throughout the Old Testament, you have this balance of, you have the northern kingdom of Israel is often referred to as the tribes of Joseph or the descendants of Joseph. And the southern kingdom, which is Judah and Benjamin, is often simply referred to as Judah. So the two southern tribes. So Joseph and Judah are the two leading, tribes that take leadership over the tribes as a whole. And so not surprisingly, the section that's explaining the origins of Israel gives particular prominence to the story of Judah and the story of Joseph. And so you have Judah apart from his brothers, Joseph apart from his brothers, a lot of parallels between those two accounts. Then you have three journeys down to Egypt, the first in 42, the second in 43 through 45, the third in 46 and 47, and then the final section is the passing of Jacob and Joseph in chapter 48 through 50. And so chapters 46 and 47 relate the third journey into Egypt. That's the section that we're in now. And like the first two journeys, this third journey can also be divided into seven basic scenes. So you have God appears to Jacob in scene one, and then Jacob journeys to Egypt. Joseph meets Jacob. Joseph's brothers meet Pharaoh. Jacob meets Pharaoh. Joseph cares for his family and for Egypt, and then Jacob prepares to die. And while there are, of course, a number of differences between this third journey and the two that preceded it, all three journeys start with the decision by Jacob. They have a midpoint that deals with some form of confinement to the land of Egypt, and they conclude with Jacob talking about his death. And so all three journeys have those three things in common. The last time we were in Genesis, we dealt with the second through the fifth scene of the third journey, and so we pick up the story with the sixth scene of the third journey, found in 47:11. So we'll be picking up the story in 47:11. If you have a Bible handy, you can go ahead and open up to it there. And that would be great. So Genesis 47:11. And Joseph placed his father and his brethren and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph nourished his father and his brethren, and all his father's household with bread, according to their families. And that according to their families, he's nourishing them with bread, he's giving them food, according to their families, it's according to the little ones that they had. And it's just a little point that Joseph didn't defraud the Egyptians in order to enrich his family. He provided them also with what they needed to survive and no more. So he gave them what they needed. He provided for them according to their families, but he didn't, you know, take all the food that belongs to the Egyptians and give it all to his own family. So that's verse 11 and 12. And then we have in verses 13 through 26, we have the story of how Joseph cares for Egypt. So some have seen these verses as out of place or wondered what they're doing there. However, just as 47:1 through 12 ties up the loose end of the journeys in 42 through 46, So also does 47:13 through 26 complete the story of Joseph's rise to power in chapter 41. As one commentator put it, this effectively interlocks the two plot elements that make up the story, the account of the family schism and the rise of Joseph in Pharaoh's court. And so you've got these two things going on in the Joseph story. You have Joseph as he relates to the Egyptians, and you have Joseph as he relates to his own family. And there's been some loose ends left in the terms of how Joseph, as Pharaoh's, chief of staff, so to speak, is going to deal with the famine. And this tells you the rest. So we've already found how the children of Israel escaped the famine. Now we're going to find how the Egyptians made it through the famine under Joseph's oversight. 47:13. There was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very sore, so that the land of Egypt and all the land of Canaan fainted by reason of the famine. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the corn, that is the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. So Joseph had gathered grain in the 7 good years, and now the state of Egypt had massive amounts of grain stockpiled for the famine. And he sold the grain to the people of Egypt and to the people of Canaan, and people gave their money and they got food and everyone was doing all right. It's important to note that Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. If you know anything about the history, particularly of kingdoms, particularly when there's a chief minister that has a lot of power, very, very often, in fact, normally, they seek to enrich themselves at the expense of the person they're supposed to serve. I won't go into all the details, but this is something in French history. Often the kings were devoted to seeking pleasure, and they'd have a chief minister who was the one who was actually running everything, a very similar situation to what you have in the story of Joseph. And often those ministers would enrich themselves until they got even richer than the king. So it'd be one for the king, two for me, one for the king, three for me, and they would accumulate power and money and titles and all kinds of things to themselves. And that's the way that the world normally works. When you have someone who's smart enough to be in that position of power, and he's the only one who knows what to do, often people try to take advantage of the skills and the fact that they're needed and to use that for their own benefit. But Joseph served Pharaoh faithfully and did not seek to profit from his exalted position. Calvin just has a wonderful comment on this. Amid such vast heaps of money, the opportunity of plundering was not less than the difficulty of self-restraint. But Moses says that whatever money Joseph collected, he brought it into the house of the king. It was a rare and unparalleled integrity to keep the hands pure amid such heaps of gold. So just quite a way of putting it, that all this money was heaping up and Joseph didn't take any for himself. And that's, I think, a good application question that we'll stop and do our first application question now. So I'm going to send that to everyone. How might we be tempted to take advantage of positions in power that we've been given for others' good for our own benefit? So all of us, because of the skills, because of different abilities that God has given us, have opportunities, and we're tempted, rather than using the position and power we have for the good of others, to use those for our own benefit. So what would be some of the ways that that temptation could show up in our own lives and in our own day?
Got your wife and Christy Tanaka with
us. Ashley had her hand up first. So let's go with her, and then we'll go with Christy.
Am I on?
Yep, you're on.
I just thought of it as a wife. It's not necessarily a position of power, but it is a position, and we can be tempted to use it to manipulate our husbands. So just what I thought of.
Yeah, I think that's really true. That is, as a wife, the Lord's given you a lot of, not speaking about you in particular, because you do a wonderful job of not doing this, but God has given wives a tremendous amount of power over their husbands, and the temptation can be to use that to manipulate them to get whatever it is that they want accomplished. And that is always destructive when that's done. Christy?
I was just thinking, this is not like a specific example, but I was thinking of leaders, and I think there's kind of like a stereotype where like a leader is more just like, I know what to do and I won't listen to all your little problems. I guess just a little bit of callousness to people below you in need. And that's a lot different than like Jesus. He actually stooped down and served. I think that could be a temptation, is just to be callous toward other people's needs below you.
Yeah, I think that could certainly be the case. And I think that fits in with even what April commented, you know, playing favorites among employees. And I think there's, you know, sort of two things. One, we're called to serve other people. So we're not just called to not take advantage. We're called to not take advantage for ourselves. We're called to positively take advantage for the benefit of others. But I think Joseph shows us an example of at least not doing what we're not supposed to do. Sorry, too many negatives there in that sentence. But hopefully that makes sense. But I think, you know, that's the example of Jesus that, you know, it's so much like in the New Testament, you know, the Old Testament speaks about not murder. And Jesus says the reason why we're not to murder is because we're positively to love our enemies. So he takes it that much further. It's like, yes, do this, but do even more than that. So I think that's good to remember that. Cindy said, it's definitely a temptation. Another place in parenthood, micromanaging and controlling what's not in our scope. And I think that's so true and can really be something as well. And April, I may have mentioned this, playing favorites among employees is something else where we can sometimes try to manipulate those under us, you know, use our power over them, not necessarily, you know, where if we're in a managerial structure where we have someone over us and we have people under us, the temptation can be to manage those under us to make us look better as opposed to necessarily serving the best interest of the employer. And you know, in office politics, that happens all the time, that employees are sort of moved around so that somebody up the food chain can look better to those who are up the food chain above them. And that is not what Joseph did here, and that's not what we're called to do.
Miss Lori has her hand up.
Lori, yeah, go ahead.
I was thinking of a negative example from my life that I just did today. And we have some almond yogurt, and if I share it with everybody, then I only get one little spoonful. So in our house, it's an unspoken rule that only I get to eat it, and no one else gets to eat it. And so that's pretty selfish, but I'm kind of taking advantage of, you know, I do the grocery shopping, so that's kind of a bad example.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, certainly a place sometimes for, you know, parents to have legitimate privileges, but you can also take it, you know. So that's what you, something you'd have to determine in your conscience, which I won't attempt to determine for you, particularly while we're live in the conversation. But it is something, I mean, it's something I know I've done where, you know, I can speak for myself in that respect, that there's a legitimate amount of privilege that comes with, you know, if you're the dad or you're the mom, you know, in a home. But there's also a pretty fine line, and it's pretty easy to abuse that as well. And so that's something. And Bethany commented, it might be a temptation to boss your younger siblings and not respecting them and letting them grow up. I know that's something in large families in particular. There's a temptation for older siblings to use younger siblings as free labor. Well, because you're old, I'm older, you have to listen to me. And so you're going to help me get this done. That's going to make me look better and accomplish my goals. And of course, it's not wrong to get your siblings to help you. but so much of this goes to what our motivation is, and are we really seeking their good or the common good, or are we really just seeking our own good? And, you know, this is something I've seen, and sadly, I'm sure that I did this, so I'm not thinking of a specific instance, but sometimes, you know, older siblings that are given, you know, maybe a certain amount of authority as the representatives of their parents can be tempted to abuse that authority to accomplish their own goals. So, well, mom said you have to listen to me, so you're going to do this, this, and this, that if mom were around, she may not have actually told them to do all of those things, but, you know, since you're there in charge, you can take advantage of that. Anyone else? This is a good discussion. Applies to lots of areas of life. Going once, going twice. Any other hands raised?
No.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and move on. So verse 15 of Genesis 47. And when money failed in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan, all the Egyptians came unto Joseph and said, give us bread, for why should we die in thy presence? For the money faileth. And Joseph said, give your cattle, and I will give you for your cattle if money fail. And they brought their cattle unto Joseph, and Joseph gave them bread in exchange for horses and for the flocks and for the cattle of the herds and for the asses of the donkeys. And he fed them with bread for their cattle for that year. So when the money was gone, they ran out of silver. Then they mortgaged their saleable possessions. And the next year came. And when that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him. So it's not exactly specified which year of the famine that this second year is talking about. So there's been a little discussion about that. What seems most likely is that the second year is the second year after the money ran out. So first year after the money ran out, they sold Joseph all of their cattle and all the stuff that they had in their houses. So now this is the second year after the money had run out, and they've already sold everything they have to sell, and they still need money for food. And based on some hints in the text, it would appear that this is potentially the last year of the famine. So the famine is almost over, but now all the money's gone, all their possessions are gone, and they're in trouble. So when that year was ended, they came unto him the second year and said unto him, will not hide it from my Lord, how that our money is spent. My Lord also hath our herds of cattle, and there is not aught left in the sight of my Lord but our bodies and our lands. Wherefore shall we die before thine eyes, both we and our land? Buy us and our land for bread, and we and our land will be servants unto Pharaoh, and give us seed, that we may live and not die, and the land be not desolate. And so the second year, it may be the last year of the famine. It may be still in the middle of the famine. We don't know that for sure. It's interesting. The word that's translated as our bodies isn't the normal word for bodies. It's an unusual Hebrew word that seems to mean something like carcass or corpse. And particularly in the Pentateuch and the earlier books of the Old Testament, it almost always refers to dead bodies. So it's a highly evocative, emotional word. It's like, all that's left are our dried up corpses. That's all that's left. We're just corpses and we've got some land. So what are we going to do? And when their possessions ran out, then they sold their freedom. So verse 20. And Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh, for the Egyptians sold every man his field, because the famine prevailed over them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even unto the other end thereof. Only the land of the priest bought he not, for the priest had a portion assigned them of Pharaoh, and they did eat their portion which Pharaoh gave them, wherefore they sold not their land. So Pharaoh had given possession to the children of Israel. So there's a number of things going on here. This requires a little bit of explanation. So Pharaoh, if you recall, had freely given possession to the children of Israel, so he'd given them a place, and then you have Jacob, who blesses Pharaoh. We talked about that last week. And so Pharaoh has been a blessing, and now through Joseph, Pharaoh receives a blessing. And so he had given some land to the children of Israel, and now he receives back the whole land of Egypt as a personal possession as a result of his previous generosity. And while there's been some discussion of the details, the exemption of the priest from taxation is something that there's evidence for in Egyptian history. Verse 21, as for the people, he removed them to cities from one end of the borders of Egypt, even unto the other end. So we're going to come back to the enslavement of the people as a whole here in a minute. So this removing them to cities doesn't seem to make a great deal of sense, because Joseph goes on to give them seed to sow, which means he intends them to still work the land. So the whole bargain that he works with them implies that they're still tilling the land. So that they're living on the land, not in cities. So it's possible that this remove them to cities refers to something that we just don't know enough to know what it's talking about. It's also possible that there's a textual problem here. The ESV and a lot of other translations have, as for the people, he made servants of them from one end of Egypt to the other, which fits the context really well. And the difference would be much slighter in Hebrew than it seems in English. So the evidence for this comes from some of the ancient translations of the Old Testament, notably the Greek translation, which goes back to before the first century. It's also possible that they were confused and they made the change themselves. So we don't know exactly what it's talking about, but the difference in Hebrew is so small between those two, even though they have different meanings in English, I would tend to think that rather than moving them to cities, it probably is talking about another way of saying that he brought them into bondage. And moving on to verse 23, which tells the sort of sequel of this, then Joseph said unto the people, behold, I have bought you this day and your land for Pharaoh. Lo, here is seed for you, and ye shall sow the land. And it shall come to pass in the increase that ye shall give the fifth part, or 20%, unto Pharaoh, and four parts shall be your own, for seed of the field, and for your food, and for that of your households, and for food for your little ones. And they said, thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. And Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day, that Pharaoh should have the fifth part, except the land of the priest only, which became not Pharaoh's. So our first instinct, for most of us at least, with our minds shaped by the horrors of the racially based slavery of Africans that we had here in America, and all of the terrible harvest that has brought in our country and continues, the continued consequences of that even to this day, is to see Joseph's enslavement of the Egyptians as this heartless evil, like, what in the world is going on? How could this have been tolerated? But the Egyptians didn't see what was taking place in that way, and it doesn't appear to be the way the biblical writer sees it either. So this doesn't seem to be portrayed as if Joseph is doing anything wrong, even though it seems maybe odd or strange from our perspective. So you have the Egyptians in verse 25. So the people to whom this is being done, here's their response. Thou hast saved our lives. Let us find grace in the sight of my Lord, and we will be Pharaoh's servants. So they treat Joseph as a hero at this point. So a few points on this. Number one, ancient slavery in the ancient world, in this context, slavery could be a good thing. So we shouldn't allow our view of what's known as chattel slavery, which is what was practiced in the American South and indeed throughout America at various points, to color our view of what Joseph did. It actually allowed the Egyptians to retain a larger portion of their income and a larger amount of freedom than we have in America even before the shutdown. While Joseph claimed a total of 20% of the total production for Pharaoh, the total government spending as a percentage of GDP in the U.S. was about 35%. So Pharaoh's, I'm purchasing you all as servants, was actually taking a smaller portion of the total for Pharaoh than our government takes for itself. And of course, that percentage is going up pretty much by the minute right now, as GDP goes down and government expenditures go up. Another way to look at this is that ancient slavery, when it was done well, was actually more like, in our world, more like tenured employment, as one commentator put it, whereas the free man was more like someone who's self-employed. So the self-employed person has more freedom, but the self-employed person also has more risks. And so because of that, many people exchange their time for a certain amount of income, and so they enter into this relationship. And law, except that this servant relationship was permanent, whereas you are free to change the job that you have. So law allowed the Old Testament law actually had provisions on the assumption that some people would find this desirable. And so law allowed for permanent servitude as a free choice that someone would be likely to make. So if, you know, so in the Old Testament code for Israel, servitude was normally a temporary thing, but people might be so happy with their situation that they would choose to make it permanent. And as a second point, so the first point is we shouldn't allow our modern preconceptions of African slavery to color what Joseph did to the Egyptians. We need to understand it in terms of its own context and make the right parallels to our own day. And the second is that in the context of the ancient world, what would have struck the Egyptians is the generosity of Joseph's terms. So during the reign of Hammurabi, for instance, in Babylonia, the state share of the harvest from the fields that it administered varied between two-thirds and one-half after the deduction of production expenses. And so taking a 20% cut in the ancient world would have been seen as very generous, where Joseph was feeding them, he was taking care of them, he was providing for them, and he was giving them still four-fifths of their harvest. And so that would have been seen as very generous. So their gratitude is not feigned. He's not being a harsh taskmaster. He's actually being kind and generous to them in the economic system of the ancient world. And this highlights, so that's the second thing, is that the terms, actually what would have probably struck the Egyptians is that they were getting a really good bargain, not the other way around. And third, that one of the reasons that this story is in here, and the reason it goes into all of these details, is it highlights the ingratitude of the Egyptian enslavement of the Hebrews. So because of what Joseph did, so Joseph was raised to power. He dealt honestly with Pharaoh, and he provided for Pharaoh. So he gained for Pharaoh control over all the land of Egypt. And he did so on terms that gave Pharaoh control and yet provided for the Egyptians, and he exercised wisely and well so that Pharaoh's power grew and yet the people remained happy, which is really quite a remarkable balance that Pharaoh gained more power and the people were also happier, which is usually those two things are mutually exclusive. But Joseph, in his wisdom, pulled it off. And so the fact that Joseph did this for Pharaoh, but Pharaoh, the later Pharaoh, who arose over Egypt, decided to ignore what Joseph and he decided to oppress the children of Israel, just shows how unfair and unjust what the Egyptians did to the Hebrews were. So whereas Joseph had done, in a position of power, had done terms that worked for everyone, the Egyptians brutally enslaved the Hebrews and made them work all the time and engaged in forced labor. And so when you start digging into the terms of what Joseph did to the Egyptians, the contrast between what the Egyptians went on to do to Joseph's descendants becomes even more striking. And that's really the reason that these details is given to begin with. And verse 26, and Joseph made it a law over the land of Egypt unto this day. This has some general correlations. So we don't know enough about the details of ancient Egyptian law to be able to use this for precise dating or to answer some of those questions. But particularly the freedom of the priest from taxation is something that's known from other sources about Egyptian history, and the percentages and some of those things, they fit, like a lot of things in Genesis and Exodus, they fit generally with what we know, but we just don't know enough about Egyptian history to be able to correlate everything precisely. So we don't have enough of a network to know, a network of data about Egypt to know how to fit the two together perfectly. And while we've been talking about this, Cindy commented, Joseph, like Christ, in a sense, provided for the people out of the abundance of the throne. And I think that certainly the way that the Lord provides for us could be an analogy there. Any questions or comments about this scene six, where Joseph provides for his family and for the Egyptians, before we move on to the next scene? Going once, going twice. Going three times. All right. Well, we'll go ahead and move on. So Genesis 47 now and verse 27. And Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And Jacob lived in the land of Egypt 17 years. So the whole age of Jacob was 147 years. And the time drew nigh that Israel must die, and he called his son Joseph and said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and deal kindly and truly with me. Bury me not, I pray thee, in Egypt. But I will lie with my fathers, and thou shalt carry me out of Egypt, and bury me in their burying place. And he said, I will do as thou hast said. And he said, Swear unto me. And he sware unto him. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. So verse 27, Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions therein, and grew and multiplied exceedingly. And there's something that's really interesting here. I'm just going to look at one thing real quick here. Where'd that go? My pages are out of order here. Oh. There we go. So Genesis 47, 27, Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt, and the word dwelt, so in Hebrew, verbs have number, so it tells you whether it's a singular or a plural. That's very rare to determine that in English. But in Hebrew, the word for dwelt is singular, and then you have a singular use of Israel, and then in the second half of the verse, it becomes plural, and it's referring to Israel as a nation. So there's this interchange between Israel as a person, that is Jacob, and Israel as a people, that is the children of Israel. And of course, this is intentional, and it underscores how the sons of Israel are becoming a nation as God had promised. So God had promised he would make them a nation, and so we find this shift between Israel as a person and then the children of Israel as a nation, and even this shift is showing how that line is being blurred, and God is building a people. And verse 28, Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. How many years did Jacob live with Joseph before his captivity? How many years did Jacob have with Joseph before Joseph was made a slave? 17. That's right. And so Jacob lived in the land of Egypt for 17 years. And if you go back just a little bit earlier, if you go to 47 and verse 9, the days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. So now Jacob's 147 when he dies. So he had 17 years with Joseph when Joseph was a young man. And now when Joseph is restored to him, he gets another 17 years with Joseph exactly, which is interesting and probably not coincidental. And 17 years after, there's something else with the ages of the patriarchs. It's probably going to sound odd at first, but I think it really conveys a significant point. So Abraham lives to be 175. Isaac lives to be 180. Joseph lives, Jacob lives to be 147. And Joseph lives to be 110. Now there's a pattern to those numbers that you wouldn't see at first, but the pattern is this. So 5 times 5 times 7 is 175. 6 times 6 times 5 is 180. 7 times 7 times 3 is 147. And 110 is 5 times 5 plus 6 times 6 plus 7 times 7 times 1. So you have a square root that's going, so you have 5 square, 6 square, 7 squared, times 7, 5, 3, 1. And I'm going to read this quote and then I'll explain it. Through their factorial patterns, the patriarchal chronologies constitute a rhetorical device expressing the profound biblical conviction that Israel's formative age was not a concatenation of haphazard incidents, but a series of events ordered according to God's grand design. So this is something that we saw with the genealogy of the way that all of the numbers added up to this perfect symbolic number of the total number of Jacob's descendants. And the seemingly random, out of control circumstances of the birth of Jacob's children, when it was looked back through the lens of faith, looking back over past history, it was revealed that it all matched the pattern that God had intended all along, that was only visible in retrospect. And this is the sort of thing that's actually quite common in the Old Testament, that there are these numerical patterns, often quite intricate, and this is something that we know that the ancient Hebrews really cared about. So this is, there's abundant evidence that these were the sorts of things that people paid attention to, and they were really concerned about this in the ancient world more generally, not just in the Hebrew Bible, but even in the time of Christ, that these were things that people paid attention to. They wrote about them. They talked about them. And the having these intricate patterns where the numbers, if you just see the numbers, 175, 180, 147, they seem totally random. But they actually fit a precise pattern. And Joseph is both the successor in the pattern. So you have 7, 5, 3, 1. So he's the last number in that sequence. And he's also the sum of his predecessors. So 5 times 5 plus 6 times 6 plus 7 times 7 is the age of Joseph. And that's actually quite significant. And it's not at all coincidental that that fits exactly the place that Joseph has in this story, because Jacob is about to adopt Joseph's two sons as his own sons. And so Joseph is going to be both the son of Jacob, but also the father of two of the tribes of Israel in his own right. And so it's just something interesting. If you don't find that persuasive, I'm not at all worried to try to convince you, but it seems to me to be a little too clear cut for coincidence, and it fits the pattern, and I think it fits the overall message of Genesis very well when we see this in other places. Any questions about that before we move on, or anything else about this? Going once, going twice. So some of this may seem a little odd from our point of view, but from the point of view of the biblical writers, it was something that seemed normal to them, and I think it's not arbitrary. So, and he said, swear unto me, and so, where's that? Which verse is that? Verse 31. And he says, swear unto me, and he swear unto him. Now, the last time that Jacob asked someone to swear to him, who was it that he asked to swear to him? Jacob has said this before. Does anyone know?
Talking about Esau and the birthright?
Uh-huh. Esau and the birthright. So before I move on to that, Cindy asked me a question. What was the multiplication of 147? It's 7 times 7 times 3. So you have 5 squared times 7, then 6 squared times 5, and 7 squared times 3. So the first pattern is going up. The second pattern is going down. So that's that's that. But moving on, it's Jacob. Jacob is stealing the birthright. And so the last time that Jacob asked someone to swear to him, he was trying to steal something. He was doing everything underhanded. But now the situation is radically different. And just looking at those two stories side by side, how Jacob was scheming and conniving. April commented, and the only person who's calculating these numbers simultaneously is Pastor Dave. I can see you doing that. So, and so just the contrast between what he was when he was dealing with Esau, and now he's being open and above board, and he's about to plead with Joseph to bury him in the land of Israel. And Israel bowed himself upon the bed's head. So that's in verse 31. And those who see the second dream. So when we talked about the two dreams of Joseph, we talked about the fact that some see the second dream as Joseph going one too far, that Joseph was, you know, the first dream was from the Lord, and the second dream was Joseph exalting himself. And so we're going to find in chapter 50 that exalting himself to a place that belongs only to God. So seeing it as a negative Joseph self-exaltation, and the fulfillment of the dream is when Joseph says, am I in the place of God, in chapter 50. So he recognizes, you know, when I was young, I put myself in this exalted place, and now I've realized I'm not in the place of God. So if you see, if that's how you see and we went into all the details in the notes several weeks ago, several months ago, actually, now. But if you see the second dream as, if you want to account for all of the ambiguities of the second dream, this is the only time that Jacob could possibly be said to have bowed down to Joseph. So one of the problems with seeing the second dream is you have the sun and the moon bowing down as well as the brothers. So the brothers all bow down. There's never a clear-cut instance where Jacob bows down. And, of course, Joseph's mother is already dead, so she never bows down to him. But if you're looking for a place where Jacob bows down, this would be the only thing that could be interpreted in that light. So that's a possibility. And I find good arguments on both sides for how to interpret that second dream. And it may be intentionally ambiguous in some ways. So that's all for the second journey. So that brings us to the end of chapter 47. And that brings us to the end of the whole section that deals with the three journeys. Any questions about any of that before we move on? Going once, going twice. So the next section is chapter 48 through 50, the passing of Jacob and Joseph. And one writer broke it into seven scenes as the previous three journeys, but it seemed a little comprised, like he was really trying to get seven scenes. And so I broke it into five, which seemed a bit more natural. So in chapter 48, you have Jacob blessing Ephraim and Manasseh. In chapter 49, you have Jacob's last words and his final breath. And in his last words, you have him dealing with all 12 of the tribes of Israel. And in chapter 50, you have Jacob is mourned, 50 verses 1 through 14, you have Jacob is mourned and Jacob's buried. And then 50, 15 through 21, you have that final finale of Joseph's relationship with his brothers. And then in 22 through 26, you have the passing of Joseph himself. I would press on to the next section, but I don't think we can do it in 10 minutes. I think it'll be clearer if we leave it for next week. So we might just conclude a few minutes early, unless there's any more questions that anyone has or comments. I planned on moving into the next section, but I think it will be probably better to not try to get that started and not be able to finish the next section. So before we wrap up, any questions or comments about what we've done up to this point? Well, let's go ahead and conclude with a word of prayer. Father, I come before you, and I thank you for how good you are. I thank you for this opportunity to have studied your word together. I pray, Father, Lord, that you would help each of us to continue to be faithful to you. I thank you for the faithfulness of our church and what a tremendous encouragement that has been. And I pray, Father, you'd help us to continue to be faithful and to know what faithfulness looks like in the days and weeks and months to come. I thank you for your goodness to us in your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.